Oh, my. That was authority.
We'll call the Health and Human Services Finance Committee meeting to order. First order of business is to approve the minutes. Representative Zuros, having taken a look at them, approves them as reported. Any additions or corrections or changes? Seeing none, minutes are approved. All those in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Approved. That being said, members, today we want to provide an opportunity for those impacted by direct care and treatment programs at the Minnesota Department of Human Services to come and talk with us about the issues they're seeing in their programs. We were hoping to have Mr. Nobles from the Legislative Auditor come and speak to us today. But due to a scheduling conflict, he is not able to join us. However, we will be hearing from him at a future hearing regardless of the timing of that. Today we plan to hear from a family member, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and finally from the unions. And so with that being said, first up, we will call to the testifier's table Sue Abderholden from the Executive Director for NAMI. And I believe that she has a family member with her, Connie Kishel. Welcome to the committee. And just for purposes of the record, if you could recognize yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today about the direct care and treatment programs at DHS. I think it's important to put in the role of DCT into context within our system. It used to be that they were the only game in town, but now they are just a small part of our mental health system. Far fewer people with mental illnesses are served in our state hospitals and IRFs and are served by community providers. The care, other than at the security hospital, is largely short-term. So there really is a need now to reassess the role in our continuum array and how they work with community providers, counties, and health plans. They sometimes refer to themselves as a safety net, but really they're not. A safety net is catching someone as they fall, but their role is well after someone has fallen very ill. So they have a distinct role that could be better defined. They should be providing treatment to people with the most serious mental illnesses who cannot be treated anywhere else, where you need additional state funding in order to meet the needs. So building or expanding the program should be done very carefully. NAMI agrees that there needs to be better staffing at the security hospital and that it should be focused on treatment and activities to keep people busy, occupied, and moving forward in their recovery. I'd like at this time to turn it over to Connie to briefly share her story, and then I'll finish up with my remarks, if that's all right, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kishel.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Yes, state your name for the record, please.
My name is Connie Kishel. Good afternoon. I'm here today speaking as the mother of an adult son who has resided at Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter since 2011. The commitment process was difficult and very sad for Mom. Over the first couple years of adjustment, his as well as mine, there was apparent in-house turmoil resulting in major staff resignations. There also was a lot of negative publicity related to patient and staff injuries. In March of 2012, new management was put in place. Soon, a family advisory council was initiated at the request of NAMI and in collaboration with the new director to provide input on treatment, services, living conditions, along with family involvement. Planning was begun with the collaboration of NAMI and consisted of the MSH executive director, five staff directors, and two family representatives. After several months of planning, our first meeting was held in January of 2015 with 13 family and friend members and 22 staff in attendance. The executive director, Carol Olson, myself, and another parent co-chair these meetings. We have continued to meet monthly and are just celebrating our two-year anniversary. Our attendance has varied, but usually is met with 4 to 5 family or friends and about 15 staff. The first presentation of the Partners in Care Advisory Council was a training on how to be an effective member of an advisory council. Other meetings have had presentations, Q&As, and challenging discussions of the various disciplines of psychology, social services, nursing, behavior analysts, vocational, and security counselors. We will continue these presentations with rehab, dietary, and others. Some of the accomplishments of our council have been to review and rewrite admission welcome packets, to establish procedures for more effectively disseminating patient information to families, to increase consistency of visiting rules across units, to revise the campus map to be more visitor-friendly, to provide input on hiring qualifications, to provide input related to fixtures, furniture, and wall coverings in the newly constructed buildings, to assist with establishing a forensic website, to implement Skype for patients and families who live out of town using 3 new iPads, and to improve the visiting room atmosphere. The Partners in Care Advisory Council was also invited to participate on the committee revising the Rule 36 variance. I feel we've had a good amount of success due to the relationships that have formed between families and staff. There is growing trust, honest feedback, transparency, care, and genuine desire to improve services and create a more therapeutic environment to help all patients improve and better deal with their mental illness. We are a work in progress, and I'm very thankful to the staff at MSH for being open to us as moms, dads, sisters and brothers, and friends of patients at MSH and the transition program. As a mother whose son is a patient there, I do believe that there needs to be more treatment and activities on campus. It's hard to get better when there is little to do. I hope you will consider increased funding for mental health, OT, and vocational staff in order to provide more needed clinical services and more therapeutic opportunities for patients, especially in the evenings and on weekends. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your attendance today. Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some other issues I wanted to raise is, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, we know there are clearly problems happening there. Families did not used to be afraid to bring their loved ones there, and now they are. It used to have an outside advisory committee and lots of other types of committees that involved community stakeholders to talk about discharge planning and things like that, but those have ended. We think they should look to have a family advisory committee like at the security hospital so they have greater input from individuals with mental illnesses and family members and really open their doors and create better collaborations. Second, the 48-hour law has been a total disaster for our mental health system. Who gets into Anoka first should be based on who needs it the most, not where they're coming from. As a reminder, prior to the law, there were 245 people admitted from hospitals, 52 from jails, and when you included some of the other locations, it was a total of 359 admits. In 2015, 2 years after the law, there were 96 from hospitals, 100 from jails, and 268 overall admits. I don't have the 2016 figures, but I'm going to bet it's worse. So we have reduced our capacity by about 90 people a year. And we also hear this is impacting the admissions at the community behavioral hospitals. The incentives for counties to move people back to their communities has also not worked. So they were supposed to be paying 100% of the cost of care when the person doesn't need to be there anymore. So now they're paying $1,300 a day, basically, for people at Anoka, and the money's going into the general fund and actually not into building our mental health system. And I just want you to imagine how much mental health treatment you could provide in a jail for $1,300. On occupancy rates, there was legislation passed last session requiring a quarterly report to the chairs of the committee on the number of licensed beds, the number funded, the number of staff, the number of positions filled, and the number of OSHA reportable injuries. This was for transparency, but it would be helpful if that report was actually made public to anyone who would want it. It's somewhat frustrating for us to see, you know, you're adding money to those buildings, especially at Anoka and the CDHHs, and not seeing those beds being fully utilized when we have a crisis right now. On the Commitment Act, we now have counties wanting to do dual commitments, and we have people saying that the law needs to be changed. And we agree that it's time to look at it by creating a task force led by the Supreme Court, like was done in 1996. Yes, 1996 was the last time we actually looked at the Commitment Act with all the stakeholders. Whatever you do, please do not do this piecemeal. Do not change one little thing here and one little thing there. Bring everyone together to really figure out how to move it forward and based on what's changed in our community. Lastly, let me say that the best way to relieve the pressure at Anoka and the community behavioral health hospitals is to actually to continue to build our community mental health system. Let's intervene before people get this sick. Let's make sure that they have access to treatment when they need it. Let's not tell them to wait 3 months after the beginning of a psychotic episode. Earlier intensive treatment works, and if we do, this will help. And let's also have places for people to live where they can work on their recovery. Safe, affordable, supportive housing absolutely does work. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, any questions for the testifiers? Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I understanding correctly that first and foremost we need crisis beds to deal with people when they're having, I forgot the term you used.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, psychotic episodes?
Psychotic episodes?
The department just announced three programs starting in first episode programs in Minnesota, and they're actually outpatient programs. So that we're able to, right now it's an average of 74 weeks before someone having their first psychotic episode receives treatment. So the goal is to actually get it down to 4 weeks, 3 weeks, and you can actually use a lower dose of antipsychotics so they don't have the side effects. So it's really the point is to try to intervene early and intensively so they don't actually need to go into the hospital or a crisis bed.
Follow-up, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, what the feedback I'm getting from the community, from my school district, is that there's a shortage of crisis beds. Do you agree with that, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely. And crisis beds, of course, are a different level of care than an inpatient hospital bed.
Yeah.
And we would absolutely agree that that is a wonderful alternative. I mean, you're coming into an emergency room. You know you're not doing well or your loved one isn't doing well. They need help, but they don't meet hospital level of care. So having an alternative is really helpful. You might remember that in 2015, you actually asked the Department of Human Services to also look at how you develop youth crisis beds because we're not sure how to fund them. And that research is actually happening right now to try to figure that out. But we've always been supportive of more crisis beds. And I did a 40-city tour this fall, went to every corner of the state, and the need for crisis beds certainly came up along with housing wherever I went.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Kissel, for your work. It sounds like you've done a lot of really practical improvements that benefit probably everyone who works and lives there, and I think the part of treatment is being able to retain that support of your family members and to have them feel welcome in being part of that treatment and care support system. So thank you for that. And I'm wondering if Ms. Abderholden could tell us any reason why she thinks that the advisory committees have ended at Anoka, because that seems like we're taking a step backward. We've made a step forward at one facility and the other one we're stepping back. Or maybe that's not an appropriate answer for you, question for you. Maybe it's for the department.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would suggest asking the department. So, you know, we're sometimes limited in our capacity to follow everything, and so we're not sure kind of what happened. But I know that 10 years ago I was getting invited to a lot of different meetings at Anoka, and and it doesn't seem to be happening. And I think because of the success at the security hospital, I think, you know, forming a more robust, you know, if it went away, which is what we think it did because we don't hear of any families participating, having a similar thing at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center would be very helpful.
And then my last question would be,
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. I heard from Ms. Kissel that, you know, more treatment, more activities would help. It would drive, I mean, if I had uneven ability to maintain my mental health, if I didn't have anything to do and I was locked in a place at nights and weekends, that would be very difficult for me. And I can understand where that is difficult for people who are staying there. But I'm wondering, Ms. Abderholden, since you're part of a national organization, if you're aware of any states that have more intensive treatment in the type dealing with the types of patients that get committed to St. Peter, and whether they're able to reduce the stay, because the average stay of 7 to 8 years is amazingly long. And I remember, you know, hearing from others that there isn't, partly because of workforce shortages and the inability to get psychiatrists and all those sorts of things, but that there isn't enough intensive treatment, and then we could actually free up a lot of beds if we could do a more intensive treatment program so that people could recover faster. And are you aware of states that have different models of treatment that we should look at in partnership with DHS?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we do know that some of the staffing patterns are more robust in other states. I don't have the data on whether that has actually impacted the length of time that someone is there. I think the difficulty as well is with when you're committed as mentally ill and dangerous, there's a longer process for you to go through. However, I do think that the change that you made in 2015, where now, though, everyone is reviewed every 3 years instead of indeterminately, will actually help us look at people's treatment plans and how things are going a little bit better as well. But I'm happy to look into that and get back to you as well.
Thank you.
I think we have some representation from the department that could address this. If they'd be willing to come down and maybe address the committee on behalf of the question that Representative Loeffler raised. Ms. Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So my name is Carol Olson. I'm the Executive Director of Forensic Services. We did a comparison of two like facilities that treat individuals very similar to those that we treat at Minnesota Security Hospital. One was in Oregon. It was Oregon State Hospital, and the other one was in Fulton. Fulton State Hospital. It's a little bit difficult to compare lengths of stay because their commitment process is so different than ours. But they certainly, when we compared staffing, I think our commissioner yesterday talked about the staffing ratios, and at those other two facilities, the staffing ratio was 3.3 staff to every one patient, and at our facility, we sit at about a 2.2 staff for every patient that we serve. And that is really the drive behind our request for more staffing for forensics. And it is certainly to support the direct care staff that are working the 24-hour, 7-day a week, but it's also to support clinical staff, OTs, recreational therapists, vocational staff, special teachers, all those that can provide that very active psychiatric treatment to our patients.
Follow up, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, because I know we have a lot of other witnesses to hear from, but I'd like to learn more. Thanks.
Thank you for coming back down.
Yeah.
Any other questions for these folks? Okay. Given that, next we have a representation from Minnesota Hospital Association. So as Ms. Krinke approaches the table, welcome to the committee. Could you just state your name for the record and who you represent?
Super. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 146 hospitals statewide and healthcare systems across the state. And thank you for this opportunity to share our perspectives with you today. We truly believe that mental health issues are the biggest public health crisis we have facing our state today. We are hearing from our members all across the state, every corner, small towns, large towns, all over the state, that they simply can't meet the demand for mental health services within their communities. And I know that there are a lot of different challenges, but we've kind of looked at this and said where we could contribute the most is to look at the issue of patient flow and how do we move patients to get them to the right care settings that they need. We've looked at this and really have recognized that we really need to get patients into the community services that they need. Talking to a couple of our members, they've shared with us that they've had patients that have been in the hospital sometimes for over 300 days. One of our members shared with us that they had a patient that had celebrated their second birthday at a hospital, staying there for over 365 days because they couldn't find placement in a community setting. There's obviously a lot of challenges, and I was very appreciative of the comments that Ms. Abderholden made regarding the 48-hour law. One of the biggest challenges that we have as hospitals right now is our inability to get patients into the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, and they need that higher level of specialized care. Every day that we cannot transfer patients into Anoka means that oftentimes hospitals that don't offer inpatient mental health services are boarding patients in their emergency room. And this is really a bad situation when you have patients that just stay in an emergency room for an extended period of time until you can place them in an inpatient bed. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think the 48-hour law has certainly contributed to that. So we decided that we needed to do a study and to look at this and look at the issue of how many people are in inpatient settings who don't need that level of care. And we've called this study our PAD study, Potentially Avoidable Days Study. And we worked with the Wilder Foundation and Wilder Research to get this done properly and to get the research done thematically. And our study found that nearly 1 in 5 days that mental health patients spend admitted to inpatient community hospitals could have been avoided. 1 in 5 days. This works out to be approximately 48,000 potentially avoidable days from just the 20 hospitals that participated, and these are the larger ones that do mental health services. So we did some numbers on this and worked it out, and we calculated that it works out to be about 134 patients a day. So if you think about that across our system, and I know there's a lot of talk about whether we need more inpatient hospital beds, but if we could get the patients that we have currently in hospitals and get them into a community setting, that would free up a hospital bed for somebody else who could be potentially waiting in our emergency rooms or out in the community that can't get into an inpatient psych bed. So we know that there are a lot of bottlenecks, and this is a big challenge about how do we get the patients the services that they need at the appropriate level of care. So also in our study, we asked why. Why can you not discharge these patients that you've already met their inpatient acute care needs, but you're not able to discharge them? What were the top reasons? And the first one was lack of beds at our state community behavioral health hospitals was number one. Second reason was lack of chemical dependency treatment facilities. The third reason was lack of intensive residential treatment services. Those are the housing, the IRTS facilities. And the last one was the inability to place people at Anoka. So as we look at this, we know that we need additional capacity at Anoka as well as our community behavioral health hospitals. And we're very appreciative of the money that was allocated last year. But we need to keep monitoring that to make sure that those resources are adding additional capacity. Even with all these expenditures that have been done, we know that the state needs to continue to make more investments in mental health. MHA is working on a bill this year that we hope will jumpstart some of the community alternatives. It's what we're calling innovative grant fund, and we're getting the legislation drafted now, so we hope to be back to this committee here soon. But I think if I could just leave one message today, we know that we need hospitalization to be more accessible, but we also know that needs to be reserved for those patients that truly need that level of service and that we need community options for discharge placement. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do have a one-page summary. It's not long. It's short. I have a one-page summary of our potentially avoidable days study, and I think it's kind of interesting. and I'd like to share that with the committee if I can. So
I think we can get that disseminated. Ms. Krinke, while you're readjusting, I have a question for you with regard to patient flow, and I'm just wondering what the topical dollars we're talking about in terms of moving critically concerned patients from emergency rooms into a lesser circumstance. What's the dollar amount or the potential amount of money that that we're really talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, obviously servicing and caring for people in the emergency room is the most expensive option, and so we know that does add costs to our healthcare system. So if it's appropriate for those individuals to be placed in a step-down type of facility, that has the potential to save money. I know you're looking for something more constructive than that in terms of dollars. When we did our potentially avoidable day study, we made the decision to not really look at the money. This was more about getting the patients the right care that they needed.
But institutions make decisions based upon the bottom line, Ms. Krinke. And so, you know, that I think is something that this membership with dealing with the finances of the state probably will appreciate when you come back with that legislation.
Super. Thank you.
Representative Pantheon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, my question is kind of a follow-up to yours. How many hospitals do you represent?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we now represent all the Minnesota hospitals. It's 146 hospitals statewide.
And could you tell me how many of those have discontinued inpatient psychiatric services in the last 10, 12 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Constantine, I don't think any of them have discontinued their inpatient bed service. I think what has happened is that they have not expanded the beds to keep up with the demand. So I think a more accurate question is maybe how come they haven't expanded to meet the needs that's happening more so than have they taken beds out of mental health delivery?
Follow up, Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I am aware of, in Mankato, that Mayo Systems has cut their beds in the last few years. I'd have to go back and check, but they used to have an entire ward, okay. And they don't anymore.
Ms. Krinke?
Mr. Chairman, members, we keep track of which beds are staffed, and if they are now using those beds for other purposes, I can go back and look at our bed tracker that we keep and maintain, and I can see how many beds are being staffed now. I'm not sure what capacity they had 10 years ago, so I'm sorry if I didn't answer the question from a more historical perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher.
What?
Did you have a question?
Nope. Nice try, though.
Representative Liebling. He has no question.
She has no question.
I have no question.
You have no question either.
Well, then. We'll
stay. We'll stay.
Are a lot of people with you?
Quick about Representative Dean.
Just a Representative Considine's comment. One of the best, I think, hearings we had last term was when we talked about exactly this issue with the beds, availability of beds in hospitals and the flow to that. And there was a testimony, and I believe it was from Brainerd, and it was a physician who was trying to manage that wing, and they had folks who were there for very long, taking up beds, that they just had no place to, nowhere to go. And they couldn't keep the beds that were open would be filled immediately, and so that there was a backlog on the other end. They couldn't get into the hospital because somebody couldn't get out. And the overlap for every person who was there too long was 5 days for every day that they could get somebody in. So in other words, they were there five times too long if they were there too long because of placement. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who was there who clearly needed to go somewhere else was violent. And a woman, a 19-year-old woman, talked to her roommate. She said, "I'm thinking about killing myself. And it's, you know, I read something, said I should talk to somebody. I'm talking to you. What should we do?" They got on the phone. She did the right thing. She showed up at the hospital, checked herself in, and had to deal with this gentleman who was violent, left immediately, went back to campus, and said, "If you're ever thinking about killing yourself, don't tell anybody." And it was like one of the one of those moments where you kind of you know, it gets through to everybody at the same time. But it was a very I thought that testimony, particularly in talking about how these facilities work together, is a big issue. So it's one that we're trying to figure out.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, to comment on that, opening up the bed so that it's available for somebody in the community is one of the goals that we have, is just keeping, we need to have some beds available for that crisis situation, that teenager who does want to commit suicide. Not having that bed available often means they're shipped out of town or they're sent someplace else further away from their family and resources. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kricke, for your testimony. Finally, we have several staff members from the unions who are with us today. And so I'm going to invite Mr. Hesse as well as Ms. Spangers and Ms. Modlin, Ms. Gettle, and Mr. Moriarty down.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the invitation to testify.
You can just name, state your name.
My name is Eric Hesse.
And who you represent.
And I am a proud union member with Ask Me Council 5. Three of us will be testifying today. I'll be speaking about bonding for construction projects to improve safety for staff and patients at DHS facilities. Jackie Spaniers will testify about the need for safe staffing. And Alethea Modlin will testify about saving a mental health program for children. I am a security counselor at the St. Peter Regional Treatment Center. For nearly a decade, I've worked with mentally ill and dangerous patients in both the admissions and crisis care units at the Minnesota Security Hospital and now with civilly committed sex offenders in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I was brutally assaulted by a patient and nearly lost my eye. He punched me in the right eye, fractured my orbital bone, popped my sinus, and I received 17 stitches. I'm not alone. Ask Me members who work at state-run mental health facilities are injured by patients on nearly a regular basis, ranging from sprains, torn rotator cuffs, a broken back, and stab wounds to the head. My coworker, Kaya McMillan, was one of them. She suffers from a traumatic brain injury after a teenage patient repeatedly threw her head against a brick wall. Please watch this video to see what her injuries look like.
Words hard to listen to as an employee at a state security hospital describes how a patient viciously attacked her.
And it's because of it, in incidents like that, that Governor Dayton is pushing for safer work environments at those facilities. Fox 9's Paul Bloom joining us now. And Paul, after hearing her story, you'll see how critical this is.
Kelsey, for the very first time, Kaya McMillan is sharing her story. This is a woman whose passion it is to care for and work with the most dangerous of the mentally ill. She signed up for the job, but she certainly didn't sign up for the horror that unfolded last July. Is this a long, lifelong, permanent injury?
Yes. I mean, I haven't been able to drive since that day, take care of my daughter, go back to school.
Kaya McMillan chokes back tears as doctors at the U of M Medical Center monitor her brain activity around the clock.
It's just affected every single aspect of my life. I never imagined it being like this.
It was 9 months ago. Kaya was working as what's known as a security counselor, but the most volatile of the mentally ill at the State Security Hospital in St. Peter. She reports that a teen patient with a history of violence
had gotten out of control. Kyle was part of the team trying to get the young man out into a courtyard to calm him down when he snapped.
He came at me and punched me in the face and grabbed me by the hair and threw my head against the brick wall that was right there a couple of times and then kneed me in the back of the head, and that's when I lost consciousness.
Kaya, 25 and working on her master's in mental health counseling at the time, suffered a traumatic brain injury. Seizures follow. Doctors are now trying to get those under control with this hospital stay that could potentially last up to 10 days. From her bed, she is now anxiously following the debate over state funding for the treatment and care of the mentally ill. She's been told her vicious assault has inspired Governor Dayton to push for significant upgrades and additional workers on the St. Peter campus.
More staff will help. More security will help. It's at least a starting point. But, I mean, more training, more logical training.
As for her future, Kaya has no idea what comes next.
Even if I end up being okay physically, mentally, I don't know if I can ever go back and do what I've been working towards my entire life. So I don't know if I'm going to be able to provide the life that my daughter deserves. It's changed everything.
Well, Kaya has not been able to return to work or school since the attack, and she needs help from her family caring for her precious four-year-old daughter. She tells me she still has so many nightmares about what happened, she actually takes medication to help her sleep peacefully. Paul Warren, Fox 9.
Breathe through your nose again, okay? Come on.
Mm-hmm. I have to pull that, sorry.
Come on, okay. Yeah. Can I do the IM?
Yeah.
We recognize that our work is dangerous, but getting hurt isn't part of our job description. We just want to work a safe shift with sufficient staff in a work site that's designed to protect us and our patients. You can help us by supporting Governor Dayton's bonding proposal. It includes $7.5 million to save the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services program in Wilmer. The 16-year-old who assaulted Kaya should have been in this facility, not in St. Peter, where his behaviors were triggered by adult patients. The bonding proposal also includes $70 million for the security hospital in St. Peter. The renovation would separate vulnerable adults from predatory patients, and it would eliminate blind spots that make it difficult for staff to account for patients. Parts of our campus date back to 1890, and they need to be repaired and modernized. This investment has been delayed year after year. It's urgently needed to prevent more injuries like Kaya's and mine. The governor's bonding proposal also includes $2.25 million for the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. They desperately need security cameras and a worker down system with alarms. They need plexiglass around nurses' stations and fences on three courtyards where patients go outdoors. Improvements for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program at Moose Lake and St. Peter would get another $27 million. The additional beds would prepare certain offenders to return to the community. Some sex offenders may never be rehabilitated, but for the few who no longer pose a threat, we need a path for their release. It's how we keep our program constitutional. Otherwise, the courts can shut down the program and release all the sex offenders. Bonding bills require bipartisan support. I urge all of you to find common ground and bond for our safety.
Thank you for your testimony. Spangers?
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Jackie Spangers. I'm the president of Local 1307, AFSCME out of Anoka. Thank you for the invitation to testify. Eric spoke about bonding. I'd like to speak about safe staffing. Our union represents 250 workers at Anoka Regional Treatment Center. I've been a nurse there for 20 years. I'm joined by my coworkers who are here to ask for your help. State psychiatric facilities in Anoka, St. Peter, and Moose Lake have become dangerous places for us to work. We're inadequately staffed, and we don't have the training or the tools to handle more patients with more aggressive behaviors. Violent offenders are frequently assaulting staff. They kick, scratch, bite, and choke us. They spit on us and chase us with weapons. They yank our hair and hit us with furniture. I was injured on the job. A patient jumped a nurse from behind. I tried to intervene, and the patient shoved me into the sharp corner of a counter. My bicep ruptured, and my rotator cuff was torn. Now I can't do the things that I enjoy doing in my private life. Kaya suffers seizures. Eric almost lost an eye. Injuries are common, not rare. We're walking around wounded, and we feel like punching bags. Getting pounded in the face or head leaves you with serious injuries, some that can end your career. Concussions, headaches, memory loss, open wounds, broken bones, and eye injuries are common. You can see our injuries. We've documented them on Facebook at Safe Staffing MN. Forced overtime is also unsafe. Working double shifts is downright dangerous. It puts everybody at risk. When you take care of mentally ill patients, you have to be well rested. When you're not, your reaction time is slower. You're not prepared for a patient who comes at you with a weapon. Person-centered training or person-centered care isn't working. In practice, it means there are no consequences for patients' actions. One patient was allowed to masturbate naked in the hallways for 3 weeks. Staff and vulnerable adults shouldn't be exposed to that behavior. He was permitted to ejaculate on staff. There were no consequences for his actions. In the real world, people can't behave that way. Mm-hmm. Our job is to prepare clients to lead productive lives when they return to the community. To that, nurses need psychiatric staff to develop care plans that recognize the complex conditions and unique therapeutic needs of our patients. Generic one-size-fits-all treatment plans have put staff and our federal funding at risk. DHS has a service improvement plan to change that, and frontline workers need to be involved in that process. I bet you're wondering why we do that work. Yeah, we need a paycheck. Everyone does. But there are safe jobs with better pay. We do this work because we care about our patients, even those who beat and bruise us. They're sick. They're mentally ill. They get violent when voices in their heads tell them to hurt people. Our skill is to help patients take the meds and turn off those voices. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. But we give it our best shot every day. We urge you to invest in safe staffing at Anoka, St. Peter, and Moose Lake. Please permanently fund the new positions requested by Commissioner Piper. We have plenty of managers. What we need are more frontline staff. I'm retiring this year, and I want to leave Anoka safer than I found it. Don't let our cry for help fall on deaf ears. Don't simply shift the violence to another group of workers at a different facility. We recognize that our work is dangerous, but getting hurt isn't part of our job description. We just want to work a safe shift and return home to our families who depend on us. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Maudlin.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chairman Dean and the committee members. I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to testify. My name is Aletha Maudlin. I'm the president of Local 1574, which is in Brainerd, Minnesota. I'm a direct care worker and an LPN. Eric spoke about bonding. Jackie spoke about safe staffing. And I'm going to talk to you now about saving our mental health program for our children, like my son, Jacob. Jacob was born with severe autism, and he is my pride and joy. I have four children. I love him very much, but he was a little bit more than I could handle. Being a single parent and only one person around, he used to beat on me as well as my younger daughters. We couldn't handle all his violent outbursts at home, at school. I prayed for help from God every day. The saving grace was when we were able to finally get him into the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Service program that's in Wilmer. It's also known as the CABS unit. It's a temporary placement for kids with severe autism and violent behaviors and that are in mental health crisis. The workers there are complete angels, and they're very patient, very caring. They worked for 6 weeks to stabilize my son with medication and therapy. He is home now, and thanks to them, he was able to come home. I'm here today to ask you to invest in this program. The lease is currently being extended, but it's not a permanent solution. You can ensure longevity of the program by supporting the governor's bonding request. It will cost $7.5 million to construct a new CABS facility. If the CABS facility is shut down, families like mine will have to send their kids to treatment programs in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin. When Jacob was in Wilmer, he was close enough that I could out go and visit as often as I could and participate in treatment. As a hardworking parent, I couldn't afford to take time to travel to another state. No family should have to choose between a paycheck and their children's health. Being Jacob's mom is a full-time job, and so is my job where I work. I beg for more staffing in our group homes. Our residents are more and more aggressive every day. Meanwhile, we are not staffed. There's not enough staff time to feed and bathe our clients. There's not enough to prepare for them to live independently, which is what our job is. No time for outings and exercise, and no time for job training. We do our best, but the state can do better for our residents and our staff. Most group homes have four residents who do require round-the-clock supervision. It's impossible for one worker to supervise four residents, administer medications, cook, clean, shop, transport to appointments, and complete piles of paperwork, never mind the additional duties of mowing the lawn, shoveling the driveway. We're burned out, and it's really hard to get a vacation sometimes. During cold and flu season, we don't even have enough staff to cover sick time. Healthcare workers end up doing triple shifts. That's 24 hours. Turnover's high because of unpredictable schedules. Makes family life very impossible and hard. We're forced to choose between our own children and our group home family. On behalf of the direct care workers, I implore permanent funding that Commissioner Piper has requested for safe staffing for MSOCs. And as a parent, I implore you to please save the CABS program. Families are counting on you to do the right thing and listening to us. And we welcome your questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm certainly greatly concerned to see those types of things happen. You know, one of the testifiers we had here just a few days ago, I asked the question, if a staff person is assaulted in one of these settings to a criminal level, which to me it looked like criminal level in some of the things you've described and also shown us here, is that patient put back into the prison system rather than left in a treatment facility? And the answer I received was yes, that is what can happen now. do you actually see that happening, where patients who are that aggressive and do physical harm to staff members, are they being sent back to the prison system and charged?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, there has been a few cases lately, especially in St. Peter, that they have gone to prison, but I would say that it's very rare occurrence that they would get charged and sent to prison. And, I mean, honestly, if they go to prison, they are still civically committed, so they will be coming back to us after they finish their prison sentence.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Were any of the patients that did these types of attacks on people that you've shown here, were any of those patients sent back to the prison system for what they had done, especially for the lady who had the brain injury?
Mr. Chair, committee members, no.
They weren't?
Not the ones that we've shown, no.
Mr. Chair, follow-up, please.
Representative Grunhagen.
You know, when I was on the school board for quite a while, one of the things that happened, we had a student beat another student up unconscious in our hallway. And not one staff member or teacher came out of their classroom to try to stop it. And the principal at the time gave a 3-day suspension to the student who had beat the other student unconscious. So after 3 days, they were back in the class, in the school, and the student who was beat unconscious was still in the hospital. So needless to say, the parents came to the school board and demanded to know why this type of minimal consequence was applied and why no one did anything. Well, to make a long story short, there were a number of incidences. This happened to be the worst at that time while I was on the school board. We voted to put an armed police officer in our school district to put a stop to this nonsense, because he had the legal authority to grab students and actually restrain them, where it seemed like many staff members under current laws were afraid to do that and get involved. Is there security police in your facilities that can deal with these people immediately, restrain them, and provide protection for the staff, or are you just walking around pretty much disarmed and having to deal with the consequences?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and committee members, and personally in St. Peter at the security hospital, I mean, there's no armed people there. I mean, we're all trained in, you know, defense and how to restrain a assaultive patient. But, I mean, it's in sex offender program, there is a response team that does have, you know, minimal, like, pepper spray and whatnot. But to answer your question, I mean, there's times where, you know, there is an assault and they're back out on the unit kind of bragging about what they did while the staff member that they injured is still in the emergency room. And personally, in my opinion, I think it breeds just a culture of violence because they see minimal consequences. So it's, I mean, if you want to speak to.
And one final question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any device like a taser that staff carries themselves to be able to defend themselves if they're suddenly and brutally assaulted in the while they're working with these patients? Or do you just have your hands and you know, what you can do physically to try to get away or avoid a vicious attack?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we don't have tasers or anything. It's just basically our training and our hands.
So you're basically unarmed and a victim with minimal consequences for this stuff. So we're creating an atmosphere where staff members can easily be assaulted and there's not much consequence, is the way it appears to me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hardly know what to say, because, first of all, thank you three for coming and sharing your story, and you know, your testimony is incredibly important here today, and I hope the members are really hearing what you're saying. You've made specific requests for how to deal with these issues. You know, there is further remodeling we need to do to the security hospital. We need more staffing and the things that you've mentioned. You know, I just have to respond to Representative Grunhagen because I think there's a lack of understanding about who these people are. These people are vulnerable adults. They are committed because they are ill. A person having a psychotic episode may be violent because of that psychotic episode, but they're a person who is there for treatment, not a person who needs punishment. And so, you know, if you send people, we hear all the time about people in jail who have mental health issues, right? With the idea that that the criminal justice system is the wrong place for these people. So granted, there may be times when, certainly in the sex offender program, where people are not necessarily mentally ill, if they commit an assault, it may be very appropriate to send them through the criminal justice system and have them go back to prison or to prison, perhaps, for the first time. That may be appropriate. But at the security hospital, and I hope you folks who are the experts will correct me if I am wrong, we're talking about patients. And you don't use tasers on patients, and you don't get a cop in there to be an armed guard. You know, you have enough staff who are well-trained, who know how to de-escalate people, and a facility where they can have people in view and not have blind corners where you don't know what the patient may be doing and so on. So I hope we can stop hearing about tasers and about putting armed guards in the security hospital. No. If there is somebody, a professional in this room, who thinks that that's an appropriate way to deal with these patients in these situations, I hope you'll come and tell us about it, because it is a lot different than having a teenager assault another teenager in a school. Unless that teenager is having a psychotic episode, and then I suppose they need to go into our mental health system.
Mr. Chair, she mentioned my name. Could I give a quick response?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the exchange, Representative Liebling. The result of putting an armed police officer in our school district is we had assaults go down dramatically, and the safety factor of staff went up dramatically. These people deserve to work in a safe environment. And if they're being assaulted by people who, and I did jail ministry for 13 years, okay? If they were in our prison system and now they're here as patients, they can learn to behave themselves. And unfortunately, human nature being what it is, there needs to be some severe consequences for wrong behavior, or it spreads like wildfire, and you get more and more this type of behavior. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we go on with further questions, we have two other people on the list that were identified to come down for testimony. I'm just wondering if you'd like to approach the testimony table right now. I think the representative from AFSCME, if you could just stay up there, I'm sure that we'll have questions for you as follow-up after these final two testifiers. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. My name is Krista Gettle, and I'm a patient advocate at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter.
My name is Michael Moriarty. I am a rehabilitation counselor at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter as well, and I'm local 1901 president.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So we had prepared some things to share with you guys today. As you know, Governor Dayton has recommended increased funding for direct care and treatment at Forensic Services to increase the clinical direction and support of direct care staff treating and managing clients with clinical complexities, some of whom engage in aggressive behavior, as you have seen and heard about. Additional funding is also requested to enhance the current staffing model to achieve that safe treatment environment that we were just talking about. The proposal requests funding for significant and sustained investments in clinical resources, tools for building a skilled workforce meeting statutory requirements, and supervision and training for new skills and techniques related to incidents and safety within forensic services. This proposal is crucial in addressing chronic underfunding and remedying staff imbalances. As you all are aware, MSOP was recently affirmed to be constitutional, and the courts are likely to continue ordering their clients out of the secure perimeter and into the community preparation services program that they have. However, they are at maximum capacity, which means they need to go someplace, right? They still need a place to go. With Phase 2 bonding denied, forensic patients are still on the lower campus in St. Peter, meaning there's no place for these people to go. All available space has been transformed to client living areas, so MSOP has taken over some of the living spaces and some of the residential areas that Forensic Services has had. Taking away, we've lost group rooms, we have lost meeting rooms, we have lost spaces that our patients are used to going to a part of their daily treatment. We're now in just one building, or we will be once we start moving up into the new one, just one building on lower campus. So some of the examples that we have that mandates that were done and staffing issues that we currently have. The legislator passed requirements that all MSH patients, including the 230-plus that are on provisional discharge, be provided with a review every 3 years, which is a good thing, but we didn't fund it. So we don't have the staff to do that. So we have staff that are working extra hours, that are working overtime just to meet that mandate that legislation has brought down. Again, great. It's a good thing, but we don't have the money to support the hiring of the staff to provide that. It takes qualified staff away from providing the treatment that we need to provide to the patients that we serve that are committed by the state of Minnesota to our facility. The positive support rule is another one that requires a functional assessment to all patients that, or all people that are committed under the 245. There needs to be support plans. There needs to be functional behavioral assessments that are done. Those are not just like, you know, a brief one-hour interview. It's a long process. Record, looking at records, developing a plan to help support somebody to develop skills so they can return to the community and be safe. So this also means instead of hiring a specialist to do those assessments, we use the qualified staff that we already have, that already have caseloads, to do those functional behavioral assessments. That, again, takes away from providing treatment to the left. I can't remember our numbers. I think we're at like 380 or something like that of patients at Forensic Services. That's a lot of people, right? There's not enough treatment staff to provide appropriate treatment. Groups should be co-facilitated, not only for safety reasons, but that's good practice. You have two facilitators to work off of each other to give the groups more robust treatment. So with the lack of staff, we sometimes cancel groups a lot of times, or we have one facilitator, which can be unsafe to do depending on the group that you're running. There is a need to provide treatment nights and weekends, but there isn't any money to hire those staff. We have, so this means that we have existing staff that are expected to work weekends, more so in the MSOP program, or we have staff that just feel pressured to change their regular work hours to meet the needs of the patients that we have. We don't do it because we are told to do it. We do it because we care. We work at the hospital because we care. We want people to get better. We know what works. We know what works. We need the funding to make it work, right? So we have staff that work those extensive hours. I am one of them. I do it because I care, and I don't get paid back for it, and I don't want to get paid back for it. My payback is to allow patients to get better, to go back out into the community, and to live successful lives. Training is another piece. There's not enough staff to allow for that consistent, thorough training that we need. We need trainers that know what they're doing and not trainers that are also staff that work at the hospital because, again, that takes away from the treatment that we provide. Currently, we have clinical staff that do both. We have clinical psychologists that will provide trainings to new employees, takes away from their caseload that they have. I provide trainings. I also am the one advocate for the entire forensic services. And so it takes away then time that I have to handle issues or address things with people. Another thing that with the training, it would help bring that, the practical technical skills that we have, to actually practice what we preach, practice those hands-on techniques that can keep staff safe and that also keep our patients safe. We do have to go hands-on. It is true. But we can do it in a way that keeps everybody safe. But we need the staff and the training to do that. You know, we get fined by OSHA. Well, then that takes away from our budget, and then we have to cut here and cut there. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. We know what we need. We just need the funding to do that. We have an issue with overtime. I mean, we have staff that have to have overtime to meet those training requirements that have to be trained. We have clinical staff who provide the training, and sometimes, you know, they're not able to do that because of their caseloads. So you may ask, what happens if we don't fund it? What's the bottom line? I heard that before. What's going to happen, right, if none of that stuff happens? And Mike is going to take over.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, representatives, thank you. So what will happen? The inability to reduce staff workplace injuries to an acceptable level. We've seen some headway with that, but we still have a lot of work to do. Continued high rates of overtime. Working an eight-hour shift, and then we don't have enough staffing, and somebody's required to work another eight-hour shift. 16 hours in one day, working with the clientele that we work with is overwhelming, and it leads to, you know, pretty high rate burnout. Continued staff burnout, like I just said, and turnover. People that, you know, they can work different places. I heard it said before, they can work different places for the same pay, but we care. And if we're working double shifts, why would I continue to work there? Well, because we care. We want to make a difference. We want to see people succeed. And we've seen it happen too often where they just decide, I can't handle this anymore. My family is more important than my job right now, and they're my top priority, so they will retire or they'll quit. The inability to retain qualified personnel with competitive salaries. We've seen a trend going on where, you know, the state of Minnesota used to have a great benefits package, great, you know, pay. We've seen other sectors catch up and pass us. There's no hiring incentives. We currently don't have hiring incentives. We don't have any recruitment retention plans. That also needs to be funded, but we don't have the funding for it, like we don't have the funding for the staffing. You're going to continue to see the inability to meet demands of the legislative mandates, such as, like Krista said, the positive support rule and mandated special review board, which happens every 3 years, which that is a great thing. We don't have the staffing to do that. You'd also see a falling short of our commitment to the state of Minnesota to provide treatment services to our patients. The vulnerable adults, the mentally ill patients that we deal with, are members of, or they're community members. In some of your communities, some of, you know, I know of a couple in mine, but they're still community members. They're still residents of the state of Minnesota, and they deserve to have the best treatment possible. And also continued citations from licensing and regulators. So in closing, Forensic Services provides evidence-based treatment for individuals with complicated diagnoses who have typically been involved in the criminal justice system. Many of the individuals served have experienced multiple treatment failures and or can no longer be accepted for treatment in less restrictive settings. Forensic Services provides treatment in a secure setting to assist patients in recovery with the ultimate goal of community placement and a meaningful life. Forensic Services' goal is to provide state-of-the-art, evidence-based treatment that is recognized across the country. We used to be that facility until our funding was cut and we fell behind to the point where we are archaic in our treatment delivery. But we have made progress, but we can do more. We can only do so much with what we currently have, though. We have reached the breaking point. The complexity of patients' mental health and associated illnesses, such as chemical dependency, cognitive disabilities, personality disorders, and often multiple medical health issues, requires a professionally trained staff from a variety of clinical backgrounds. Provision of therapeutic treatment has to be driven from clinical staff who understand the complicated comorbid conditions. the best clinical practices to serve patients with illnesses of this acuity strongly suggests that in order for treatment to be effective, it must be individualized and comprehensive. Staff who provide the 24/7 care, direct care, must constantly enhance their skills while working with complex individuals. There's a high need for ongoing and just-in-time training to build proficiency and de-escalation, intervention, and engagement that leads to treatment recovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We have some members that have questions, and I'll ask the member to direct whomever they would like to ask the question of, but up first is Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine is a statement and not a question, if that's okay with you.
Proceed.
When I first practiced nursing in Marshfield, Wisconsin, I took care of people who were sick with a lot of medical conditions. And I remember taking care of somebody who was hypoxic. So he lacked oxygen because he had, I think, congestive heart failure, and he was in acute state. And I am short, and this was a fairly significantly sized man. And he wasn't getting enough oxygen to his brain, and his reaction was one of violence, if you would just look at it, if you just see him. He had stripped off most of his clothes. He insisted that all the lights be on. He was yelling and swinging at the nursing staff because he was sick. It would have been a violation of my license to do anything to harm him, to protect myself. And that is the case for nurses and doctors and people who are taking care of people in all sorts of facilities who have health conditions that cause them to behave in ways that you may not expect, that you may not consider appropriate, but they are the condition that they're in. And it's our job as providers to safely care for them, not to and use our own power, physical or otherwise, to harm them or control them. And for years I've been sitting in this committee listening to providers come and talk to us about the fact that they need more help and staff to properly care for people who are physically and mentally ill. And for years we have rejected that. And the idea that we would arm people with tasers is not only abhorrent to me as a provider, but it would be a violation of my license and a violation of many of the laws that we have in place. We have to remember that nurses and doctors and healthcare providers have a certain amount of power over the people that we're caring for because we're healthy and we have more information, and we have to respect that differential. And it cannot be the policy of the state of Minnesota that we would provide weapons in order to protect ourselves against the people in our care. It just cannot be the policy of the state of Minnesota. So we have to start listening to the providers who are telling us in all sorts of ways that they are unsafe and so are the people in their care unless we do something, which is going to cost us money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to MAPE and AFSCME, and especially for the folks who came down today for the for the committee hearing today, and we do appreciate all the really hard work that you do in putting yourself in harm's way to serve other people, particularly vulnerable people. So we do really appreciate that, appreciate all the work that you do. Just a brief comment about the bonding proposals. There are some bonding proposals at multiple facilities that we're going to be seeing coming through in the governor's request and also coming up through the bills that will be introduced in both the House and the Senate. We didn't have a bonding bill last year, so there's kind of we skipped lunch, so people are interested in kind of getting that moving sooner rather than later this year. So we understand that. We're going to be taking a look at that a little bit later. We did focus in a bit on staffing levels yesterday in our committee. I thought that was a very good discussion about that. And one of the things that I think that it's important to understand is that we are very interested in making sure that appropriate staffing takes place at the care level, and that we have in the previous
requests met to the dime the request by the administration for staffing levels in our budgets that were passed. There was supplemental requests made on top of that for additional staffing levels. And so when we look at the requests made at the facility level saying, hey, we need more staff at the care level, we need more money for this. We've got this much overtime. We've got these many injury reports. We need more folks. And then we provide that in additional money, and then we come back and say, well, what happened to the money we gave you to hire more people? How many people did you hire? And then find out that the money is somewhere else. That's frustrating to us. So we want to make sure that if we deploy more dollars for more people, that they actually get hired and they get and that they that they're on online and where they need to be. And so not all overtime is bad. I understand that many workers like overtime and the flexibility that that can provide for additional money. But when you mandate it and you build that into the forecast, it doesn't work because folks get stretched too thin. I had one question for Jackie Spangers, if I could grab her back just for a quick second. And one of the things that you had brought up earlier is safety, and congratulations, by the way, in advance on retirement. So,
thank you.
What month is it?
June.
June. All right. We got one 99 last...
99 days.
One last session. Who's counting, right? All right. Well, we do... one of the things that we're very interested in is safety. And with the policy change towards less restrictive interaction from staff, that there's good and bad that comes out of that, that people are treated more humanely with less restraints. On one hand. On the other hand, it provides more of an opportunity to be injured for workers. And it also, for other vulnerable adults, it can hurt them, or it can also limit their activities. If one person is acting out, then the others in the group can't participate, got to derail or do whatever they're doing, and their day is kind of shot too. So we realize that there's a balance between that, and part of that is training, and part of that is implementation, and there's some common sense that comes into play. And over the years, I get emails from folks who work, you know, that just send me emails just kind of anonymously or somewhat anonymously saying, this is my experience. And one of the things that I have noticed in a couple of the emails, or maybe several, is the emphasis on training, but that training on a less restrictive workplace is not translating either into a safer environment or one that is better for the client or patient, one that actually makes things less safe and doesn't have a lot of common sense when it comes into trying to help people or protect staff. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, as you're kind of looking at retirement 99 days from now, from a policy perspective, does that make sense, and is there enough ability from a policy level to allow people at the staff level to inject common sense into how these rules are being interpreted, and how does that work within a facility?
Ms. Spangers.
Thank you. Actually, the staff go through quite intensive training. Do we make decisions on our own? Unless it's something that's imminent that we need to immediately react to, no, we go back and talk to the charge nurse, and there's a team of people that actually make the decisions. Do we interpret? No. Pretty much what we're trained with, the tools that they use to train us, and I think we can get better at that. I think there's a lot of room for growth there, because what something means to me may be totally different when somebody says the same thing or reacts that way to you. So I think you've got to look at each situation, and I think common sense has to come into it. But I think we've got so many rules on you can't do this, you can't do that, you need to be the least restrictive, you need to talk them down, you need to do whatever you can without putting hands on to actually bring that level of whatever's happening down with a client. We've got a lot of room for growth. We've got a lot more education that should be used to train the staff. I hope that answers what you're asking me.
Yeah, and
Representative
thanks,
Dean.
And thanks, Ms. Fangers. And one of the things, that is the training itself. Is that appropriate and good enough to meet the goals and objectives? And one of the instances that was forwarded to me was an intermediate training session where it dealt with what to do when someone is throwing things at you. And it was a three-step process, and the first step was to, if possible, remove the object from the person if you could. And the second one would be to move out of the way if they were throwing the object at you. And the third would be to try to block the object if you couldn't get out of the way to prevent it from hitting your head or body. And that was an intermediate training level. I didn't want to ask about the basic level, but it just struck me as something that, and he kind of showed me the training exercises, that it just didn't seem to make a lot of common sense. If that was me working there, I wouldn't feel like that training was helping me create a more safe work environment or to give me the tools that I need to keep myself safe. Do you feel like the training is where it needs to be for a reality on the ground every day?
Thank you, Chair. I think we're getting better. I think we've got a long ways to go.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really hoping to avoid this.
You still can.
No, I don't think I can. Bringing weapons inside the secure perimeter, Representative Gruenhagen, frankly, is just not a good idea. It lends itself to abuse. And I'm guessing that, quick show of hands, anybody here who works there actually like to see weapons inside the secure perimeter?
We'd like to see.
Would you like to see weapons?
Yeah,
that would be, the staff doesn't want to see that. So that's not a good idea. On the other hand, Representative Liebling, when you're getting your head pounded in, the distinction that they're mentally ill doesn't really matter. It's nice to say their patients and everything else, but when Eric is getting pounded, I don't think he stopped and asked, are you a criminal or you're mentally ill? It doesn't matter at that point. And, again, I had a knee operation. I had my ribs broken out there. That still caused me quite a bit of consternation when I twist wrong. Not one that I've ever really said out loud. I had an involuntary vasectomy. Luckily, we were through having children at that point. So it's nasty, and it really is. And basic behavioral psychology says that when people do something like this, there should be a consequence, a timeout. We do that with toddlers, and that's not allowed at the security hospital. Now, they're working through it. I have talked to Eric. I've talked to Mike. I've known Krista since she was knee-high to a grasshopper. When I am talking to the staff right now at the security hospital, they're pretty positive, and they like the direction that things are going. So I'm not really going to push it, but Representative Gruenhagen, I do believe that there should be some consequences. Like I say, just putting somebody in timeout for 15, 20 minutes till they calm down is basic behavioral psychology. And I'm not sure why we've gotten away from it quite so far, but again, I'm willing to go with the staff at this point. They are working with Ms. Olson. They are happy in the direction that things are going. So I will concede that I worked there a long time ago, and things are a little bit different. So I appreciate your concern for their safety. Weapons are just a bad idea. Thank you.
We're getting closer, Considine.
That Representative Halvers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have to speak up as a former caregiver as well. I've worked on a locked facility. I've worked in nursing homes, and I've had my bell rung more than once, and have been knocked to the floor and had experienced some of those things. Fortunately, I was not permanently injured like some of the folks who testified today. It's horrible what you go through. But I will say, as a caregiver, and to quote, to kind of reflect on what Representative Murphy said, we are professionals as caregivers, and you never forget that you are a professional. And I really want to thank the professionals at all levels who have given us their testimony, the people who have come to be supportive in the room and come and talk to their legislators, because we need to understand their perspective. It's easy to sit here an armchair quarterback, but these folks are telling us clearly what they need. They need resources. And to say that we've given them resources, and that should be good enough, I don't think answers their question and answers their query, because we have seen years of cuts to programs over the years. We are not providing preventative care that can prevent a psychotic episode. And additionally, one of the things I think I'd like the testifiers to comment on, Ms. Gotti and Mr. Moriarty, is that these folks are there for treatment. They're there to get better, and people do. Psychotic episodes don't necessarily have to be forever, and what I'm hearing the testifiers say is that the lack of staffing, the inability to have an effective setup in their building to keep people safe, that we are starting to create holding facilities for people, which I like prisons, as opposed to hospitals and treatment facilities where people can get well from their mental illness, where people can get treatment. And so I would like, I guess, the client advocates and the counselors to respond in terms of what is getting in the way of those treatment plans, and what I think the assumption that there's no consequences and that the training is ineffective, I think that we need more information on that. So I'd like to hear from them, please.
We just have a few minutes left for the committee, so if you could make your remarks briefly, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Our training has changed to do in forensic services as to be more hands-on and more realistic, and we are doing that. We're just doing it with staff that already have caseloads. So the deal with training is to hire people that's their job to do. So we're not taking away from unit staff. We're not taking away from the treatment that we're providing to patients, so we can do more of that realistic, in the moment, hands-on, so we can practice being safe when we need to intervene. When imminent risk is there, imminent risk of harm is there, we do have tools that we can use. And our patients, coming from the voices of our patients, that's part of my job, they want to know that staff are confident, that they're going to be able to go hands-on without hurting them, right? And so the more training that we can do that can be real time and real life, the better, because we're going to commit it to memory. And when our heart is racing and we're trying to help out our coworker, or we're trying to help out another patient that's being assaulted, we lose 70% of what we know. So if we practice and do that real time, the hope would be that we're going to get better at it. I know that it was mentioned that we have room for improvement with our trainings. We do, and we can do that more. We just need the funding. As to speak to the treatment and the timeout piece, so to speak, there are consequences to people's actions. There are natural consequences to people's actions. Folks don't just get to leave our facility. If you're aggressive and you're not going to engage in treatment, you're going to exercise your right that you have to not follow treatment because they have that right. They don't have to follow it. It's within the Bill of Rights that they have to do. They're going to stay longer. They are going to stay longer. If they're aggressive towards a staff member or towards another patient, we do have the ability to use restraint and seclusion. It is limited now for the reason of it's not a punishment. It's to say, hey, that's not okay. You are not being safe. This needs to change, and the response needs to be consistent, which we're getting better at. And our patients are, they're feeling safer with that part. I don't know. Do you have anything to say? I can talk really long.
Mr. Moriarty.
Thank you. You pretty much summed it up in a nutshell for me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's why you're here. But, yeah, what Mr. Chair, representatives, what Krista's saying is it's just the ongoing. I mean, it's not something you learn it one time and you got it. It's yearly. We have to learn this year to year to keep it up, to see what else is new out there that's working for other facilities, and just – you know, keeping our pulse on what's going on in the mental health industry. I can't even tell you how many trainings I have per year, but they're very beneficial. They can get better, absolutely, but we don't have, like everybody's been saying, we don't have the staffing to do so because you're relying on clinical staff, you're relying on security staff to provide these trainings. Well, they also, your clinical staff have caseloads. Well, okay, we've also added other mandates onto our clinical staff, so now there's even less time for them to get their documentation and their reports written, you know, for the hospital review board, for the special review board. And, well, you can't do that right now because you have to go provide the training for the next 2 hours. So adequate staffing across the board. And thank you very much.
We have two final members that have questions. If you could be brief, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I'd like to thank all the testifiers for coming here this morning or this afternoon. I'm new on this committee, and there's been a lot of insight that I've learned today. There are some things I'm thankful for and some things I'm very disappointed, especially when it gets to the administrative side, when we provided funds for more staff, but they didn't provide the staff. That needs to be looked into very carefully as to why that happened, because we added the staff for the staff safety. One of the things I was concerned about is talking about what happens when staff get injured and stuff. And one thing I've learned in my career in law enforcement, I'm dealing with these individuals that are having their mental health problems dramatically, where they're swinging 2x4s at us, holding on to pieces of glass, threatening to cut us while cutting themselves, where we've actually had to go in and physically intervene because of for their own safety and for the safety of the other staff. Sometimes you have to be aggressive dealing with them because they have no clue what they're doing. And if their pattern continues, a behavior continues, they're going to hurt themselves or others, and that's the last thing we want to happen. I've had the training in de-escalation. We use that as much as we can, but there's times it just does not work. Timeouts just do not work. And I've learned dealing with these people, I've got relatives that have these issues. Rewarding bad behavior continues and grows the bad behavior. There has to be consequences for their actions. Even if they, while they're having their episodes, they understand they had a problem. And by having consequences for their actions, they learn to control their actions better. Yes, they still will have the outbreaks. So I think we need to work more on this. Somebody had mentioned, in my career in law enforcement, you had mentioned about training, having people just for training. In my career in law enforcement, the worst trainers were the ones that never were in the field. The best trainers are the ones working with the patients.
Amen.
Yes. So they need to have the trainers being involved with the treatment process, working with the patients, because they know that's how you learn what works, what doesn't work. I do want to continue this and do what we can for these individuals. They are citizens of this state. They are citizens. They have their rights. But we also have to look at how we can do it in the best economical way, because there's only so many dollars to go around. We have, if you go to any other committee meeting, we got people asking for billions of dollars. We don't have that money. We need to know where we can use it best, what works the best, and do what's best for these people with the dollars we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, you know, I don't know how somebody can sit naked ejaculating, according to the testimony, for how many days and nothing's done, but that's something for you to... You can talk to me offline about that. But the question really is, that I have is, you know, we had testifiers from the staff saying, we don't need more managers, we need more staff.
Yes.
I got some agreement. I'm willing to give you a taser, too, by the way. But, I mean, what is the ratio of managers to staff? I think we need there's got to be models out there. Are we over-managing and understaffing, and is that where a lot of the money's going? I know when I was on the school board, I hate to keep bringing that up, but there was always a big discussion of administration versus actual teachers and money going into the classroom, okay? And I was a strong advocate for money going into the classroom where learning actually takes place versus putting more and more administration on, okay? And there's a place for administration, I understand that. But in your opinion, are you overmanaged? Do you use any type of model in your structure of employment that is nationally recognized in terms of the amount of managers versus staff? And it sounds like we need plenty of staff. I don't know if we need more managers, to tell you the truth.
Ms. Gettle.
Mr. Chair, and I don't think we can answer that question effectively because Mike and I don't have that information. We're not in that role. And
Mr. Chair, if you could get that somehow or have somebody contact us for that, I would sincerely appreciate it.
I'm sure the DHS will have those remarks prepared and provide them to the committee. Members, with that, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last comment going to Representative Dean's concerns is that maybe as we go forward, we should be looking at encumbering some of the money specifically for staff so that it does not go other places.
Mm-hmm. Members, our next meeting is going to be Tuesday, January 24th, at which time we'll be hearing some testimony from both the Departments of Health and Human Services. They'll be giving updates on the number of programs under their jurisdiction. So a complete list of those topics will be with your meeting notice upcoming. Members, with that, the meeting is adjourned.